Well, good evening and welcome to the fifth presentation of talks in our 10th series on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Poots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with my colleague back in the pink, Peggy Wright, and with help from our webmaster moving about, Taiwan Wan. Daniel Peach designed the posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Jason Hatman. Our speaker tonight is a native of Chattanooga, Tennessee, and growing up, he wanted to be a rock star. He was influenced to study Spanish, however, by Frank Dole, his mother's cousin, who was the American consul to Honduras. John is a graduate of Suwannee, the University of the South, Middle Tennessee State University, and received his PhD in Romance Languages from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 2003. He's the author of Recuerde el Alma Dormida, Medieval and Early Modern Essays in Honor of Frank Dominguez. His article, Juxtaposing James the Greater, Interpreting the Interstices of Santiago as Pilgrim and Matamoros, was an honorable mention for the 2007 Frederick Connor Prize in the History of Ideas. He's the book review editor of Hispania and an Alabama Rhodes Scholar. Those are people who travel the roads of Alabama bringing the good news. He's currently interim chair of the Department of Foreign Languages and Literatures at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, where he teaches courses at all levels, including the honors program. He made his first trip to Spain in 1992 and has returned four times since for research, travel, and to lead study abroad programs. His interest in pilgrimage grew out of his relationship with Professor Tom Spaccarelli at Suwannee and service in their 2000 summer program in Spain. John recently coordinated Hispanic Family Day at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, an effort to reach out to the Spanish-speaking community of Greater Birmingham, complete with Latin American food and a chance to see the sacred steps on the Camino, a touring art exhibit sponsored by the Embassy of Spain. On May 19th, still time to sign up, John will be leading an expedition from the Pyrenees along the medieval pilgrimage route to Santiago de Compostela. Please give a warm welcome to John Moore.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian, for that warm introduction. Thank you all for coming out this evening in the rain, for braving the storms. I'm very happy to be here in Western Kentucky in Bowling Green with you this evening. Speaking of the Sacred Steps on the Camino exhibit, I brought plenty of brochures should you want to take one with you this evening. I've also brought an article on the trip I'm leading this summer with students, if you would like to read about that. And if you are into scholarly topics pertaining to the road to Santiago and pilgrimage, there is a complimentary volume with color plates for you to take with you tonight. I only have six of these left. One of them could be yours. So as Dr. Coots mentioned, I was teaching assistant for the Suwannee Summer in Spain program in 2000, and that's really where my interest began, and that program was co-founded by Tom Spaccarelli and Antonio Montlet of the Universidad Complutense in Madrid. And pilgrimage was a transformational experience. One of the primary definitions of pilgrimage is travel for transformation. And it has become a primary focus in my work since the 2000 trip. I feel like in a lot of ways I've been processing that journey for the past 10 years, and I've been doing so in my teaching, developing courses on the subject through articles I've written and other projects I've been, scholarly projects I've been involved in with pilgrimage, the art exhibit, and it's become a major focus. I remember before I did it, I was at my wife's grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary celebration. There was a photographer there from Yugoslavia, a devout Marian follower. And I was telling her about my plans to undertake a pilgrimage that summer. to Santiago, and she said, if you were a true pilgrim, you would be going to Fatima. And there are places such as Fatima in Portugal and Lourdes in France, which where the devotees of the Virgin Mary and the apparitions that have supposedly taken place in these places gather each year. And the pilgrims to these places tend to be devout on the whole. The road to Santiago is a bit more multifarious. There are lots of different motivations. Some people go seeking a mental, a physical challenge. Others are devout. Others have a New Age philosophy. There are lots of different reasons people go. I remember it's much like, and that hasn't changed. That's been the case with pilgrimage over the years. All you have to do is look at the Canterbury Tales and see some not so holy motivations and lots of different types of people going on pilgrimage. And that's very much true of the road to Santiago. And I think that's what this photographer was referring to when she said that to me. If I were a true pilgrim, I would be going to Fatima or Lourdes or some Medjugorje, some place like that. I remember, that's not to say the devout do not hike the road to Santiago. I remember walking one day with a woman from Estonia, a very learned woman, spoke seven languages. We were talking one day, and she was talking about how she couldn't wait to bask in the presence of the remains of St. James the Greater in Santiago de Compostela. And she asked me about my feelings about that, and I told her, honestly, I didn't know for sure whether or not the remains of St. James were actually in Santiago de Compostela. And she stopped talking to me and turned the other way. And her conversation, which had been going on for an hour and a half, was over. There are lots of different types of people that hike the road to Santiago, or bike it, or take it in a bus, or who have support transportation. And our group that year was semi-motorized, meaning we had support transportation. I later learned from someone in the medieval history program at Johns Hopkins, whom I met years after, who was on the road that summer. His group was debating whether or not we were true pilgrims, because we had support transportation. We did most of it on foot, but some sections were removed. And we were not religiously motivated, but culturally motivated. So if you wanted to classify us anthropologically, you could classify us as semi-motorized, culturally motivated pilgrims. And in fact, people have classified the road to Santiago, described it as a living museum of sorts, a place where you're walking through history and art history and legend. And the purpose of this talk today is to give you a tour of that extended museum today. In terms of the historical background, and if the music gets too loud, just let me know. James the Greater in the Bible was the son of Zebedee, not James the Lesser, brother of Jesus, but James the brother of John, the two that Jesus named Boanerges, the sons of thunder, for their feisty attitude, James, who was beheaded by Herod Agrippa, possibly in AD 42, possibly in AD 44, but his biography is rather sparse, which meant that it could be filled in, his skeletal biography could be filled in with through later legends, many of them, if not all of them, apocryphal, such as his remains were miraculously transported by boat, in some accounts a stone boat, from Palestine to across the Mediterranean, through the Straits of Gibraltar, up the Atlantic coast of Portugal to the shores of Galicia, where his remains were discovered by Bishop Theomirid in Iria Flavia. His remains produced the conversion of the pagan queen Lupa, but his body would lie dormant for centuries until being rediscovered in the 9th century. And this is when the promotion of the cult of St. James began. Why was he important? Why would this have been a significant discovery or rediscovery? James was part of Christ's inner circle, He witnessed the transfiguration on Mount Tabor, what's called the Theophany of the Transfiguration, where Christ turned into a pillar of light. And so Santiago became one of the three most important pilgrimage routes in the Middle Ages. What would some others have done? Okay, Canterbury, for sure. Also, but it wasn't one of the biggies. The biggies were Jerusalem, which was hard to access because it was controlled by Muslims for so much of the time. Rome, which also had wars and roads blocked around it from time to time throughout the centuries, because that's where the remains of Peter and Paul are. And Jerusalem, of course, where the Via Dolorosa is, the place where Christ lived, suffered, and died. And then Santiago was the third most important route. Now, it was more accessible than, and here you have James's remains being transported again to the burial site. This route was somewhat more accessible. It's sometimes called the French Road, the French Way, Camino Francés, Camino de Santiago, and you can see different roads coming from France. But the French roads are not the only way. You have the English Way that starts in A Coruña, where Dr. Coutts lived and researched for a time. You have the Portuguese Way. The French Way, the main pass, or the Via Turonense, the Via Le Movicense, the Via Podense, which starts in Le Puy, and the Via Tolosana in Toulouse, named for Toulouse. And the top three converge before the road enters into Spain in Roncesvalles or Roncesvalles. But the fourth one, the Via Tolosana, does not combine until Puente la Reina. That's where the four roads become one. And there are, of course, shrines all along the way on these French roads, dedicated to the Virgin Mary, dedicated to a number of saints, and these maintain the interest of the pilgrim along the way. So it's not as if people in the Middle Ages would just go to see Santiago, but they were going to see all of these other places along the way. Diana Webb, who's a British historian from King's College, describes pilgrimages as sort of a constellation of sites. And that's very certainly appropriate for the road to Santiago. And there are accounts such as Aymeric Picot's Pilgrim's Guide from the Middle Ages. He has a very pro-French bias, and he goes into great detail about the French monuments. And the French influence was tremendous. You have the monastic house of Cluny, the influx of that influence all across northern Spain, and you have settlements throughout northern Spain. So pilgrimage brings immigration as well. And this is part of why the road to Santiago was also called the French Road, the Camino Francés. Pilgrimage is a concept that goes way back. The locus classicus of this tradition in the Bible is in Luke 24, the story of the road to Emmaus. Are you all familiar with this story? So this is when Christ is walking along with two disciples who don't recognize him. This is after the resurrection. They don't know who he is. When is it that they do recognize him? That's right. He was made known to them in the breaking of the bread. They have to press hospitality upon him. He tries to refuse, but they insist, come inside, sup with us. He was made known to them in the breaking of the bread. So this story in part tells about the transformative power of hospitality. And hospitality is inextricably intertwined with pilgrimage. And all this has to do with the reciprocal relationship between the guest and the host. The Latin term for guest is hospes. The Latin term for host is hospes. The medieval Spanish, the Spanish word huésped, although many native speakers don't use it this way today, means both guest and host. If you look in the dictionary of the Royal Academy, the Diccionario de la Real Academia, the fifth definition is also host, even though anfitrión is used more as host today. The same is true in French. The same is true as in Greek. Xenos. Hospitality was a fundamental tenet of classical. Zeus enforced the carrying out of hospitality in classical times. So this is, it's fundamental concept to the Pashtun tribes in Afghanistan. So this is a very common tenet of many societies going way back and still today. And we see here a depiction of the road to Emmaus. Here's Christ with a shell. Does this mean that he's a pilgrim going to Santiago? To St. James? One of his own followers? Probably not. Probably indicates that he is endorsing. A shell actually could represent pilgrimage more broadly. Didn't necessarily indicate pilgrimage to Santiago. However, since this is along the road to Santiago or on a lateral road, we might think of it as an endorsement of the pilgrimage to Santiago. And St. James here, note his pilgrim's attire. He has a staff for walking or to defend himself against wolves. He has his satchel here for his provisions and his shell, symbolizing his role as a pilgrim and also perhaps providing an endorsement. And here he is again, a much later image with similar attire, but this time with a hat. Of course, as I mentioned, James's biography is skeletal, which means it could be easily appropriated. And this is exactly what happened in the reconquest or the conquest of the Iberian Peninsula when the Christians began to take over lands held by the Muslims, what is commonly called the Castilian Crusade. Santiago Peregrino became Santiago Matamoros, Santiago the Moor Slayer. This was the patron saint of the soldiers in the Castilian Crusade. However, it was this conquest that helped secure the route for the pilgrimage itself. And so there's a natural connection between the reconquest and pilgrimage. And this, here's another image of Matamoros. The later images are far gorier. Start really get going in the 15th century. After the reconquest is basically complete, it's sort of a triumphalist display of, look what we've done. And you really see these, you see some along the road to Santiago, but really in southern Spain, and then across the Americas. Mata Indios in the game. Here we have the phases of the reconquest. An image that I found that portrays the connection, sort of the fluidity between St. James as a pilgrim and as a Moor Slayer, is this image of St. James defending the soul of one of his pilgrims with a sword. The staff becomes a sword. And here he's doing so, and he's defending the soul of his pilgrim in military fashion. So the figure of James as pilgrim is not always so peaceful. My photographs start here and continue through the rest of the presentation. We started in Roncesvalles on the French border, and we have here a depiction of Navas de Tolosa, a battle of the reconquest in which Navarre was victorious against the Muslims. This is in the Gothic cloister and mausoleum within the Real Colegiata Monastery in Roncesvalles, and it depicts Sancho el Fuerte, who fought with Fernando el Santo. This is in 1212, the year 1212, on the border with Andalusia. And in this place, below the stained glass, you have chains of the soldiers, of the Christians who were freed in this battle, and their chains form the escudo, or the shield, of Navarra, where Roncesvalles is. And this, at the very start of the route, in the Spanish side, is another depiction of the importance of the reconquest to pilgrimage. Juxtaposed with it, here in the little church of Santiago in Roncesvalles, we have a statue of St. James depicted with his normal pilgrim's attire. And this is where, on July the 3rd, there was a pilgrim's mass sung in several different languages. It was St. Thomas's feast day. And in Roncesvalles, you have landmarks commemorating battles by Roland, the French knight. This is the site of the attack on Roland's rear guard, Roland and Charlemagne's rear guard. You have here a legendary battle with the giant Ferragut. And there's the silo of Charlemagne here, where Roland may have been buried, although other towns compete for this honor because they want to lay claim to that fame so that they can attract pilgrims to their own places. And other, this is the site where Roland apparently smashed his sword, Durandal, where he blew his horn, Olifant, a little too late. But other towns lay claim to this honor as well. We might think of Roland as a sort of secular saint. Those of you who have read the Chanson de Roland, who were Charlemagne's troops fighting? Or who were they attacked by? The Saracens, the Muslims, the Moors. Once again, however, the historical accounts, Einhard, contemporary of Charlemagne's, wrote about 50 years after this event, says that it was the Basques who attacked him. And you go in this country, it's mountainous, and these have been a fiercely independent people. Their language is unrelated to any other language in Europe. Linguists cannot properly trace it. They have many guesses as to where it might come from. Structurally, it's similar to Japanese, but it's not related to any language in the Indo-European family tree of languages. So these people have been around a long time, and they want to defend their lands. So they claim that they attacked Roland and Charlemagne and drove him out. So there are different competing versions of that. In any case, Roncesvalles is important because this is the site where French influence, the Carolingian influence, and the Jacobean influence, or the influence associated with St. James, come together. So this is the confluence of those. And we have a legend that has to do with this, Charlemagne's dream. Charlemagne was supposedly the first pilgrim to Santiago. He had a dream in which St. James appeared to him and said, "You must come free my lands and people from the terrible Saracens." And so Charlemagne got out of bed, followed the Milky Way, the way of the stars, all the way to Santiago and accomplished this. This is in the a legend in the Book of St. James. So this story also brings together St. James's history and the Carolingian history, the Spanish and the French traditions. And just outside of Pamplona, we have a site where the way of the winds, I don't know if you can see the windmills in the background, the way of the winds meets the way of the stars. The road to Santiago is also called the way of the stars. If you look up in the night sky, the orientation of the Milky Way, have y'all seen that in the summertime? Is oriented along the path of the road to Santiago. I highly recommend Ed Stanton's book, The Road of Stars to Santiago, published by the University of Kentucky Press in 1994. It's a great book. This is at the top of a place called the, just beyond Pamplona, called the Alto de Perdón, which my friend Antonio Monplet, an art historian who's traveling with us, says, lo que no tiene perdón. It doesn't pardon you at all. In other words, it's a fierce climb up. We had just gone through a lush mountainous region containing picturesque houses in the Basque country, villages with their own highlight courts. Are you all familiar with this sport? It's all so-called pelota vasca or frontón, sort of a racquetball type sport played with, you know what I'm talking about, wicker baskets along there. Okay. The signage appeared in both Spanish and Basque all along the way. We passed through the bustling streets of Pamplona, where the running of the bulls or the San Fermines were about to take place. There were lots of drunk English and American tourists trying to be like Ernest Hemingway throughout the streets. It was good to walk through all of that. And then there were many English and Americans there, lots of French speakers, people from France earlier on the route. And after this monument, I walked with a man from Italy and then two women from Catalonia. So in the Road to Santiago, we have a real international cast of pilgrims. This is where all of the roads in Puente la Reina become one. They converge. And this is the bridge of the town's namesake, Puente la Reina, founded and established by Doña Mayor, the wife of Sancho, that battler we saw in the stained glass. She promoted this bridge in the town. Pilgrims brought their money then as now. Even though they may not bring a lot, if you attract enough of them, it adds up. There's in this town, Puente la Reina, there's Antonio, friend and art historian, traveled with us. Here's another statue of St. James, Santiago Belza. Belza means black in Basque, used to be stained from soot, but he's since been clean. And also along the way, this town really impressed me a lot. You walk through, I had hiked the Appalachian Trail, a part of it before, and it's really wilderness for the most part, punctuated by towns every now and then, maybe a town every 3 or 4 days. Well, the Road to Santiago is kind of the inverse of that. You maybe go through 3 or 4 towns a day. It really is a walk through civilization with some wilderness and fields as well, plenty of those. One of these towns was called Sidalqui. It's a medieval walled village, very well preserved. Here you see the grapevines going over the doorways. These are called casas emparadas. And walking throughout this area, you really saw the holy trinity of classical cuisine. We see wheat here. You have olive groves. So bread, wine, olive oil. You're walking through the places where these products are grown. Walking along here, just coming out of Sidalqui, this very well-preserved town, is a medieval town, is a Roman road from millennium earlier and an old Roman bridge. In many cases, the Roman highway has become the main highway. The National Highway of Spain paves over the old Roman highways in many instances, but you still have examples of Roman construction. Which really attests to their endurance and the ingenuity of the Roman architects. And then this is a medieval bridge that shortly follows this. So you're literally walking through thousands of years of history, and this is why people think of this. You have legends of Roland and the Cid. You have thousands of years of architectural history. This is why it's described as an extended museum. Here in the town of Estella, just beyond that bridge, is another depiction of Roland. This was a town that was French-speaking until the 18th century. This is the Palacio Episcopal, a secular building. Just across the way here is a Gothic church in which, when we went in, there was a group of Japanese musicians playing folk songs from Mexico, Germany, the United States, Spain, instrumentally. So once again, the international flavor of the Road to Santiago is very much in evidence and summed up, encapsulated in this event, in this image. Along the way, leaving Estella, there was a fountain of wine Fuente de Vino. Right outside of Bodega, there's the bodega's fenced off, but just beyond it, for the pilgrims, they leave a fountain of wine. And the landscapes, of course, are something to be savored along the journey. This is another bodega, one that we, my students won't be touring bodegas this summer, but this program did. And this is a place in La Rioja. Many of you have had wine from this region of Spain. This is Bodegas Palacio. It produces over 2 billion liters of wine a year in huge vats. It's in the town, another well-preserved town of La Guardia. And this is another medieval walled city. And it's got a great view of the surrounding countryside. I don't know if you can see the mountains in the distance, and you have the tight, narrow medieval streets and very well preserved. I think they've actually been restored, this portal, to its the original paint scheme, the polychromatic paint scheme, which would have been present in the Middle Ages as well. The yellow arrows are everywhere, and that's what guides us along the dusty roads of Castile. Just beyond lies the town of Santo Domingo de la Calzada, donde la gallina cantó después de asada, where the these chickens that you see in this holy little barn, this is a church, and these are the descendants of the chickens, the roasted chickens that sang on the table as a testimony of the miracle of the little boy who was hanged because he had, he and his parents had arrived. There are many versions of this miracle tale, but he had arrived in an inn, and the innkeeper's daughter took a fancy to him, but he didn't reciprocate her affection. She took offense, stuffed a silver goblet into his knapsack, and when he left, he was accused of being a thief. She said, "Thief, thief!" Of course, he was hung immediately. His parents sadly trudged on to Santiago. Upon their return, they couldn't exactly take a jet plane home in those days, or a car. They had to walk back home. And they walked back, and there was their son's body hanging, and they were very sad. And he began to talk to them. And this was a miracle. St. James had suspended him throughout the entirety of their journey because of his gratitude for his parents' loyalty. They still made the pilgrimage to his shrine. In other versions of the tale, it's the Virgin Mary who holds the boy up and keeps him from suffocating on the noose. In other versions, it's St. Dominic himself, St. Dominic of the Highway. This is the place, a working class saint who helped build the road, who helped build bridges. He dedicated his life to this. So there are all kinds of traditions associated with these chickens. People try and catch their feathers. Pilgrims feed the chickens, except in the winter time when there are not many pilgrims going through. The locals handle it then. There are all kinds of souvenirs that have to do with these chickens. And so, in addition to being a way of walking through history, the road to Santiago is also a means of stepping through folklore, legend. And here's the boy. You can see him. And there's the chicken. That's not my picture. Now we're back to my picture. This is San Millán de la Cogolla. There are two monasteries here, the older one of El Suso and the newer one of El Yuso, the one below. We saw archaeological excavations underway, human remains here outside this monastery with a horseshoe arch. Interesting. Comes from Islamic architecture here, but we're solidly in Christian territory. We're going to see more of this in a minute. There's the monastery below, El Yuso. And here's a depiction of San Millán Matamoros. San Millán, Saint Millán the Moor Slayer. In the story of his life, he appears a long time alongside Saint James. Well, the poet of that resided at this monastery. He wanted to attract pilgrims to his shrine as well. So he had a story about San Mian, and there was a tax paid to San Mian for appearing out of the skies with Santiago on a white horse, saving the Christian troops from who were vastly outnumbered by the opposing Muslim armies. So this is a depiction of him in this capacity. And this in this place, there's a museum that has medieval songbooks, cantorales, that has Arabian tapestries, that has sarcophagi, that has the original glosses that were supposedly the first text written in Spanish. It was a Latin manuscript glossed in the earliest written form of Spanish. The originals aren't here. They were written here, but they're in Madrid, of course, where everything else is. And so this site is not along the main road. It's more of a lateral attraction. So when we say road to Santiago, it's misleading. We should really say the roads to Santiago. There were many roads to Santiago. And it's only in modern times that the route's been sort of canalized into a very narrow structure. In the medieval times, it cut a wide swath that could take in places such as San Mian, either going to the shrine or upon return. Here we're in the city of Burgos. This is the gate of Santa Maria, St. Mary's Gate. The cathedral is also named for her. There are many important monuments here. This church was built over four centuries. It houses the remains of the Cid, the famous Castilian warrior. Maybe you've seen the Charlton Heston, Sophia Loren, depicted much like in the movies. He's like Roland. He's just fearlessly battling the infidel, and it's this very much built up. It's a black and white view. The poem of the Cid presents another side. There certainly is the warrior component. He does fight against Muslims. He also fights against Christians. He also has his best friend, who is a Moor, a Bengalbon. When they greet one another, they kiss each other on the shoulder in Moorish fashion. In Burgos, in addition to typical Christian Gothic architecture, inside a Christian building, the convent of Las Huelgas, we have another manifestation of this cultural hybridity. We have typical Islamic plaster work on the ceilings. We have carpets and pillowcases with Arabic inscriptions. There was a Spanish Christian queen buried with a pillow with Arabic text that said, "There is one God, and He is Allah." Does that strike you all as odd? But what does Allah mean? God. There is one God, and He is God. So it made perfect sense. And besides, all of these products were in vogue. And in the newly conquered lands, there were workers who knew how to make lobed arches in your Christian structure, who knew how to do the plaster work and the carpets, the intricate geometrical interlace. And there's a gargoyle, I'm sorry about that. So what we might call this cultural hybridity, we call Mudejarism. The Mudejars are the Christianized Muslims. They live in the Christian territories. Moving on through Castile, we come to one of the best preserved Romanesque structures. Now, Romanesque has been called the pilgrimage style of architecture. This preceded the Gothic. It really came into being after the turn of the century, the turn of the millennium, the one before the one we just experienced. Of course, and you can see the semicircular arches. Here we have the ruins of the once important Cluniac monastery of San Facundo in Sahagún. This monastery controlled over 100 other monasteries. It maintained an active scriptorium, which produced beautiful luxury manuscripts, such as the Beatus of Lievana. In this place, we encountered children and grandparents in the plaza. It was just a really nice, relaxing Sunday afternoon. More examples of Romanesque throughout Sunday. We continued through the wheat fields, and the middle part is not very mountainous. It's pretty flat until we got to León. This is the Pantheon of San Isidro, San Isidore, where there are reliquaries of ivory and hammer silver. Here we have a Romanesque cathedral. It was actually, you can read about it in one of the articles in this volume if you get one. It was actually redesigned to accommodate pilgrims. It had a different structure before pilgrims started coming. Interesting, it has an interesting history. Up close, we have an image of the Isaac's sacrifice being stopped by the hand of God. Can you see that? And that's the false sacrifice below the true sacrifice. Here we have the lamb. It represents the true sacrifice. Another gargoyle. Here we have the Cathedral of León. In contrast to that of Burgos, this one was built in only 50 years. David Taylor was talking to my students last night. He described it, when you walk inside, the stained glass is like a jewel box. It's, in my opinion, it rivals Chartres in terms of its stained glass work. And it may have more stained glass than any other cathedral in Europe. Here we have some visions of hell if you wind up on the wrong side of the law. There's the interior of León. There's San Roque, St. Roque, the patron saint of lepers. The rose window there in León. And continuing on along our tour of the cultural of the museum, we have a Bavarian Fantasia-style castle by Antonio Gaudí. He didn't only work in Barcelona. You walk right past it in the town of Astorga. And beyond it, there's Mason. We have the town, a town that's surprising because it seems to have grown right out of the mud, to have phonically risen out of the mud, as Jack Kitt puts it in his book, Off the Road. In other words, it's hard to differentiate the paved streets from the structures themselves. They really blend in nicely together. They seem to be natural outgrowths. Beyond that, we have the Iron Cross. This is a place many people will bring a stone in memory of someone. It doesn't have to be a large stone. What we did was carry a stone from the bottom of the hill. It was kind of big. But some people bring a stone from stateside, maybe, and in memory of a loved one, will take it with them on the journey. And when they get to the top of this mountain, they deposit it in this place. And maybe it has an inscription, an engraving on the stone. So it's a place of personal significance. It was used in pagan times before it became a Christianized monument. I remember trudging up the mountainside and being passed by buses. And this is a part where the road is really on the road. It's on the highway. And cars are whizzing past you and buses. And get to the top, and the people that have been in the bus are having their picture made on top of this. And I remember, and it seems really hypocritical now because we were semi-motorized and had support transportation at times as well, but I remember feeling then it's very common for pilgrims to feel superior to one another. I remember feeling resentful. They're having their picture made, and we've hiked up. Anyway, there's all kinds of debates. Who are true pilgrims? Are bicyclists, are they even pilgrims? Can they really be pilgrims? What about people that go in cars? There are many different types of pilgrims, many different modes of transportation. So my view of what a pilgrim is has expanded considerably since then. In any case, there remains to this day tension between the foot pilgrims and the motorized pilgrims, even if that's, even if those are on a bike. Going through the mountains, we arrived to a very welcome destination of Molina Seca, where we were able to swim and cool off at the end of the day. Needless to say, the Pilgrim's Hostel at this place was filled to the brim. It's hard to get a bed there. Just beyond it, you have Via Franca del Bierzo. Right before you enter the mountains of Galicia, the final leg of the journey. Now, if you had injured yourself along the way, if you were lame, this was the gate of pardon. You could get the benefits, all of the indulgences that a pilgrim going to Santiago would have received if you were injured by arriving to this point. La Puerta del Perdón. This is the Calle del Agua. I think the river used to run through here. Now it's the main street. See lots of houses of the nobility, the former nobility along the way. And it is the road to Santiago. Though it goes through the wheat fields, it goes through the middle of towns and cities as well. Leaving, this is a Jesuit structure. We scaled the mountains and arrived to the village of Osebredo. These are thatched roofed conical structures called payosas. They have been around for centuries. This goes back to the Celts. And some say that the Celts had their own roots and their own that coincide with where the road to Santiago is today. And so there's all kinds of competing histories. There's sort of an esoteric path that people follow when they do the road to Santiago, looking for symbols. You know, you have the Knights Castles of the Knights Templar. This is the other Camino that certain people are fascinated. In any case, these structures have been around since prehistoric times. And here's another view of one of them and the roof of a payosa. We moved on to the Alto de San Roque, the summit where you have this patron saint of lepers. There's Laura, myself. You have European chestnuts along the way. Things all of a sudden get much greener again once you get into Galicia. You start seeing cows. And this is La Chata. This is a woman I felt compelled to write about in my journal. Here's what I had to say about her. The most archetypal Spanish countrywoman I've ever seen was herding cattle in front of us today. She was La Chata, the pug-nosed, rough mountain woman of Juan Ruiz's Book of Good Love, Libro de Buen Amor, or at least her living reincarnation. As we were trapped behind her and her bovine caravan, we got caught up in her poetry, her song, the rhythmic cadence and brusque punctuation of the words she used to prod these creatures along and to keep them in line. It was a moment that could have been 7 centuries ago, and time seemed eternal because we were forced to her pace, to that of her animals, her life, and her time. I tried to resist the urge to take a picture but could not. She was the real thing, and I was a tourist. The tension also between pilgrimage and tourism. Here, and it's funny, a guy who was presenting to my students last night has a picture that could be the same picture. It may be the same woman. You have these archetypal figures that reappear in different people's photographs. This structure is famous to Galicia. It's called an oreo. It's used to store grain or whatever you want to keep the animals out of. But they've become refurbished lately, and it's a source of regional pride for Galicians. Here we are in Puerto Marín. This was a town that was moved from the riverbed and then rebuilt up above. This church, which is the Church of San Nicolás, also called the Church of St. John because it was built by the Knights of St. John, was dismantled and rebuilt stone by stone atop the hill. You look closely and you see that the stones have numbers on them. And that's why. And beyond this church and through this oreo, we come to Mount Joy, Monte del Gozo. This is the place where pilgrims traditionally started singing, Dum Pater Familia, celebrating because they can see Santiago on a clear day from here. The end is in sight. We went on from Monte del Gozo to the northern entrance of the Cathedral of St. James, the traditional entrance. We participated in the pilgrim rituals, such as inserting our hand into the tree of Jesse. This is a stone pillar below the statue of St. James, and Christ above showing his wounds. And this pillar has an indention from people, so many people sticking their hands into it. So you can fit your hand inside of the pillar because it's so worn away from centuries. That's where I have my hand right there. Another tradition is to butt your head against Master Mateo. This is a representation of the sculptor of this Portico de la Gloria, the porch or portico of glory. Another tradition is to give a hug to St. James. This is a statue of Santiago as pilgrim. This is the statue. Some people kiss it, but when the swine flu broke out, this was, you said there was a picture in the Spanish press of Hugo Chavez kissing the statue, but he was one of the last ones because they were asking people, let's please stop kissing the statue. We don't want to transmit this virus. And then the remains below the statue of the purported remains of St. James and two of his followers. And there is the statue that people hug. So there are all kinds of traditions, rituals that people participate in, whether they go to Santiago, whether they go to Mecca, whatever the tradition. You walk around, there's circumambulation around the Kaaba in Mecca, you walk around the church here. There are all kinds of rituals in common to pilgrimage. These are the rituals, some of the rituals that take place here in Santiago. Now, we arrived right before St. James Day, which is July 25th. He's a patron saint of James of Spain still. St. Teresa was competing with him for that honor for a while, but St. James held on. So July 25th is kind of a big day. There's the cathedral. It has a Baroque facade, Romanesque interior. Around the town, there's lots of celebration, lots of music. Because of the Celtic influence, we have bagpipes, you have parades. One of the rituals is the Bota Fumero. This is a giant incense burner that's about the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. And it's swung by five men pulling a rope up and down, and it goes higher and higher and higher, all the way to the top of the barrel arch and back again. And when it comes down, you just hope it doesn't break loose from that rope. And you can see the interior of this church. It's really the height of the Romanesque. We're used to Gothic churches being very tall and airy. We're not. Romanesque tend to be tighter, more compact constructions. This church on the inside represents the limits of Romanesque. This is the height in the 12th century. There's an image of Santiago the Moorslayer who hovers directly atop the canopy of Santiago the Pilgrim, the one that everybody hugs. Again, close relationship between the two. You're hugging St. James the Pilgrim, but St. James the Moorslayer is out of sight, but still integral to the full canopy of the altarpiece. Bagpipe troops that I told you about. It's a beautiful city. You should really go. They call Galicia the Ireland of Spain. It's worth a journey, for sure. And there's the year 2000, European Union. There were, in addition to the bagpipes and the processions and all the celebration of St. James Day, there were fireworks, and it was a nice ending to the journey. Thank you all for coming today. I'm happy to take any questions that you have. I'll do my best. And don't forget, I've got these materials for you. If you want an article or the brochure or one of the essay collections on the road to Santiago and pilgrimage, be my guest. Yes, Peggy.
Are the inhabitants friendly, or are they just tired of all the preaching through their countryside, their hillside, their towns?
It's a culture of hospitality. It's and that's not to say it's universal. I mean, there are individual variations, but there are there's a culture of hospitality that's been around for a long time. The Pilgrim's Guide has stories from the medieval times saying, if you don't provide hospitality to pilgrims, this is what can happen to you. There was a woman, and she didn't want to provide, share her bread with the pilgrims that came to her door. And so she hid it underneath a chair. And when they left, she got her bread out to eat it greedily, but it had turned to stone. Somebody else who refused hospitality, and the whole village that refused hospitality, and their village burned down in a fire. Now, the premise of hospitality goes back to the story of Emmaus. Now, when the two disciples pressed hospitality on this individual, they didn't know who the stranger was. This was a stranger, but he turned out to be Christ. So this is the moral of the story. You never know who the stranger might be. So that's the theory behind it. In practice today, there are organizations that provide hospitality to people, and this is what they do. This is what the people in the pilgrims' hostels do.
You began with the seashells, and I thought maybe you would be talking about what that signified, and the question that would follow if you tell the story of why the seashell and what it represents, and could you do that? And then is that still now given to those persons who travel and shows that they have been?
We have evidence of people using the shell, the shells that they acquired in once they made it to Santiago on the return journey to show that they had made it to Santiago. Today, people wear it from the beginning of their journey, and they wear it throughout to symbolize themselves as pilgrims. The shell has lots of different meanings. It's presented in funerary sculptures. It could be associated with the portal to the afterlife. It is in legends of St. James, one of them, when St. James's boat came on shore, there was a boy on horseback, and he went out to sea to greet this boat. And when his horse came out, it was covered in scallop shells. And so there are all types of legends that associate the scallop shell with St. James, the pilgrimage to St. James specifically, but also in the Middle Ages. As I mentioned earlier, the shell can symbolize pilgrimage more broadly conceived, not just to Santiago.
Other questions?
For those
one back here.
Sandra, I'm going to ask more practically, from Roncesvalles to the end of the journey, how many miles did y'all travel and how long did it take you?
The full journey is over 700 kilometers, roughly 500 miles. As I mentioned, we were semi-motorized. We probably did 400 of those miles, between 300 and 400, and we spent 3 weeks doing it. The group I'm doing the road with this summer, we will be starting in Roncesvalles, proceeding on foot and going all the way. And we will be spending 5 weeks doing, attempting to do every step of the way. Mm-hmm.
Will you go through the Basque country?
Yes, you go through, well, it's not the formal País Vasco, but you go through Navarre, which has Basque influence and Basque signage. But there is a route, it's called La Ruta del Norte. It goes along the coast through San Sebastian and these places. So there is part of it that goes through the official autonomous region of the Basque Country.
And then your trip ends there and
you
fly back home?
Yeah, so modern pilgrimage, one of the drawbacks of it is, does it really give you time to decompress at all? You've been on the road and having and interacting with people from all over the world, thrown into the Victor and Edith Turner, I guess the most famous theory of pilgrimage. This husband and wife, they're anthropologists. They came up with this notion of communitas or liminality, where people from different backgrounds were thrown into new circumstances, which creates a state of flux and new possibilities for interaction. New modes of interaction made possible is how they create. So you experience this belief, and then all of a sudden it's over. In the Middle Ages, people would have time to walk back, but today we don't have that
pilgrimage was a circular route. One left from her home and returned to her home in a circle. But today, one goes, it's a linear phenomenon today, more so.
Other questions? Still recruiting students for the journey?
We have a full roster. We've been doing the academic preparation since January. And they'll be writing their investigative report until August. So this is a half a year program, really.
On behalf of Debbie K. Leavitt, I want you to join and thank John Miller for coming out on a very rainy evening to share his story of pilgrimage, and hope this is something that you'll consider doing in the future. I passed through it on the train and hope to get back one day. Again, thank you all. We hope you'll join us next month when we'll be exploring a faraway places trip to Alaska. Thanks and good evening.